Tonight on Arena, we remember Florian Schneider of Kraftwerk, and Deirdre O'Kane and Michael McElhattan look back 20 years to Paths to Freedom. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Earlier today, the death was announced of Florian Schneider, co-founder with Ralph Hutter of Kraftwerk, one of the most influential and innovative bands of the 20th century. Schneider had in fact passed away last week. He had been ill with cancer and was buried privately, a discreet ending in keeping with the way he and other members of the band went about their music and their lives. Gavin Friday joins me now on the line. When did you first come across the work of Kraftwerk, Gavin?
It was 1974, and it was their first single, Autobahn, which is a totally electronic piece. It was a hit single, but it sort of went in and went out. It was 2 years later, I saw Bowie for the first time in 1976 for his station tour in London. And he opened, he didn't have a support act, he had a film, a Dali Bunuel film on Chien Andalou, and the soundtrack was Kraftwerk, Radioactivity, and that sort of kicked in for me.
Yeah, Bowie was a huge fan. What do you think it was, you know, the influence that they had? They came out of Dusseldorf and Cologne, but what was so distinctive about their sound?
Well, it was all electronic, first of all. I mean, they started off sort of jazz, pop, prog rock in the early 70s, but Kraftwerk were totally electronic. And the real innovators, I know a lot of people talk about Giorgio Moroder and I Feel Love, which is a work of art in its own way, but it was really Kraftwerk who had the future sound, a sound that took off big in the early 80s with all the futurists and electronic bands. So they were doing it before anyone was. And also their aesthetic, the way they looked and how they, and the promo films, it was sort of timeless.
Yeah, how important were there those visuals, that visual aspect of the work?
What was extraordinary about it was where they really started breaking through was in 1977 with the album Trans Euro Express. And they had that sort of futuristic gentleman's look, which went against the grain of everything that was happening in the music business then, because it was punk was kicking in. But they were embraced by punk rockers, they were embraced by even black culture in the early 80s. It was a huge influence on dance music. They sampled or tried to imitate Kraftwerk and sort of house music as well. So
You saw them live, and they had that same ability that they had in the studio that could reproduce that live. You saw them in Dublin?
I did. It was later, much later. It was like 2004, and they played a small gig in the Olympia Theatre. But they had the incredible movies and projections, and they used 3D projections. So even in this sort of stage production, we're way ahead of everyone, using sort of live film and making it not just a show. It was more of an event.
Which I guess is why their influence goes way beyond electronic music. It's much bigger than that.
It is, and it's strange. I mean, I think once they defined it as folk music of the factories, and then my favorite of all their albums is Trans Euro Express. There's a track there called Franz Schubert, where they see themselves as making contemporary folk and classical music in their minds. They said that, and it has that longevity. It's sort of timeless. You listen to stuff from 1975, 76, and it's as fresh and as new as anything you'd hear today.
And I suppose it's totally in keeping with the way the band handled themselves. That I know there's a cultural thing involved in the lateness of the announcement of the death, but they were very private and are very private people.
Yeah, I mean, Florian, who was the main man with Ralph Hutter, he left the band in 2008, and seemingly they never spoke about why. No one knows why they broke up. It was just very, very private. They didn't really do media or press. So, yeah, in keeping mystique and sort of Germanic control.
Yeah, there's a touch of that going on for sure. Well, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. And we'll bring you back to that first hearing, in fact, Gavin. We'll go back. That's Gavin Friday there speaking to me about Florian Schneider, whose death was announced today. We'll go back to 1974 and one of their great tracks, Autobahn. There you go. The feeling of driving along a motorway was what you're supposed to feel when you listen to Autobahn. We don't get much of a chance to feel that at the moment, do we? That's it. The Autobahn, the famous track from Kraftwerk, 1974, and that to commemorate Florian Schneider, whose death was announced today. 20 years ago, a six-part series aired on RT Television. The series followed the lives of two men from Dublin, both just released from Mountjoy Prison, but both from very different sides of the socio-economic divide.
The Irish prison system is more crowded than at any time in the state's history. For those who pass through it, what in fact does it achieve? To answer this question, two prisoners agreed to let us share their first 12 months of freedom. For a year, we followed them, tracked their trials and tribulations, their attempts to reclaim their lives as they took their first tentative steps on their separate paths to freedom.
Bye. The opening sequence there to Paths to Freedom, a six-part series, aired 20 years ago on RTE Television and now once again available on the RTE Player. The two men in question were an aspiring rapper, musician and poet from inner city Dublin. He was called Raymond Rats Doyle, and a consultant gynaecologist from Black Rock on Dublin's south side. He was called Jeremy Fitzgerald. Now, if you didn't see the series first time round, and if you haven't realised it yet, Paths to Freedom was in fact a mockumentary made as the so-called Celtic Tiger was gearing up to roar very loudly indeed. To look back 20 years, believe it or not, to that series, I'm joined now by its writer and co-star, Michael McElhattan, who played Rats, and comedian and actor Deirdre O'Kane, who starred as Helen, the wife of Jeremy. 20 years ago, does it feel like that, Michael? And do you remember your haircut is the most important thing?
Unfortunately, it does feel like 20 years ago. And I do. It was a hair piece, actually. And I remember having to fight for that ever so slightly. It was just a look that various people were wearing. And it managed to lower my IQ fantastically. So it was Rats without the wig would be nothing.
Maybe I should ask Deirdre to actually describe Rats's wig, because you might be able to give it more colour than Michael might be a little bit shy to really describe it. How would you describe it, Deirdre?
It's probably a little kind of bowl monk cut, is it, around the front?
It was pre-Peaky Blinders, was it? It was a bowl cut. It was a bowl cut. Yeah.
It was something extraordinary. Give us an idea. This started out as a project for you, a character that Ian Fitzgibbon, who is the narrator in the piece, whose voice we just heard in that clip. It was a character that you, I think, were playing around with, and he suggested that you develop it more, Michael.
Yeah, it was a character I'd been playing around and doing for the amusement of my pals in bars for years. And we didn't really know what to do with him. And then Ian Fitzgibbon, who was the co-writer and director of the series, saw me up one day and said, look, why don't we try to do something with this guy? We got together and came up with Jeremy and Helen. And it all moved incredibly quickly. We then went to our producer, a guy called Michael Garland of Grand Pictures, who was fantastic and was very excited by the project, who took it then to Mary Callery, who was the new commissioning editor in RTE, and she loved it. Mm-hmm. And it happened in dribs and drabs, really. We were given a little bit of money to write the first episode and another little bit of money to write the second episode. But I think from commission to it coming on screen was less than 9 months.
That's quite quick, really. Deirdre, yeah. When did you first see the script and first see Helen in all her glory?
Well, Michael reminded me that we used to meet in the Herbert Park Hotel to thrash out the characters and to discuss them. And so that's how it kind of came about. The script then, I think I didn't see it till quite close to shooting time. But I think I knew the character very well before I laid eyes on the actual script.
So in fact, there was a sense that there was a large input from you as an actor and as a comedian at the time into the development of the character.
Yeah, I think there was quite a bit. I mean, I certainly wasn't the one who was sweating with the pen in hand and actually doing the writing, but I'm a good talker, so I was happy to improvise on what she was like, and I knew plenty of women like her.
Right, well, let's listen to a clip which will give us a sense of who she is and what she was like. She's the wife of Jeremy, as you said, the consultant gynaecologist in the piece. He's just spent 6 months in prison for dangerous driving causing bodily harm. And here Helen reflects on how she kept herself beautiful, even while visiting Jeremy in prison.
Imagine if I didn't look after myself, for example, and I'd gone to visit Jeremy in prison, looking like something that the cat chewed up. I went in there looking super, with my head held high. I'll tell you something, it's not actually that easy to do, you know, when you're surrounded by scrubbers. I don't know, there are women out there who've never set foot inside a salon. They expect to hold on to their men, they look afraid.
It's actually quite expensive, though.
It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. There's always something you can do. Do you know, simple things, cucumber in the eyes, anything at all, you can just chop that up in your own home. There's lots of things you can do, there's no excuse, absolutely none. Think of all the treatments you can have now. Pedicures and manicures and waxing, reflexology, oh, it's endless. Liposuction, for God's sake.
Deirdre O'Kane there as Helen in that clip from Paths to Freedom. Can you remember it as you hear it, Deirdre?
She's absolutely hideous, isn't she?
But I guess that's part of what you were going for, particularly her attitude. You know, she refers to the scrubbers, which would be the people from the other side of this divide, that were the socioeconomic divide that we might talk about. She really doesn't care for anybody who is not privileged and wealthy like she is.
Yeah, she's just a snob. She's through and through snob, old school. And I always remember hearing that phrase years ago, there's no sin in being poor, the sin is in looking it. And for some reason, it lodged in my head. And I think I attached that to Helen. You know,
mind
she had
you,
an attitude that was just like,
yeah,
you can find a way to look well, you know.
Yeah, she might find it more difficult now, of course, to find a salon. She might have to pay even more money than she had to pay back then. Michael, how much did you really want to just be ironic about that class divide and about the snobbery that we see, particularly in that upper middle class family, Helen and Jeremy? How much irony was there, but how much serious social commentary was there as well?
Well, I think there was a lot. I think it was equally offensive to both storylines, without a doubt, you know, and that probably got away. We got away with a lot of stuff then. But there was, I mean, we were being ironic, but I think there was, you know, a lot of truth in that as well. So it was an elevated, you know, looking at the both storylines and elevating those. But that was the plan.
Well, let's have a listen to Rats in Action then. And he liked writing poetry, and here he is talking about writing poetry and how it helped him get through prison life.
They're coarse and silly, yeah. That's what kept me head down, kept me head sorted, you know. That and poetry.
You read poetry?
No, write poems. Do you want to hear one?
Love to.
It's pretty hard to write poems because you just have to get them to words to rhyme with other words, yeah. Do you know how long that one took me to write? Like over 10 minutes, you know? Do you want to hear it, yeah? Do you want to hear it? Okay. Daylight comes crashing into me room, like an angry bride who's lost her groom. My head it throbs, my mouth is dry. Thank God I'm straight, not homo or boy. Sexual, yeah? To win you back, I would rob a bank, or would put all the poets into a big tin tank. To write you poems in verse all blank, I'd go to the moon for you. I would have no fear, but you would have to let me have a beer. Sometimes.
So, the poetry plays quite an important role in your life.
Yeah, it keeps me focused, keeps me totally zen.
Raymond Doyle, Rats, played there by Michael McAlhattan in Paths to Freedom, which is coming back to the RTE player after its first airing 20 years ago. And Michael McAlhattan and Deirdre O'Kane speaking to me about it this evening. He is equally hideous, it has to be said, Michael.
He is equally hideous, yeah. And a lot of people kind of, you know, view him as this kind of lovable aegis, really. But Rats was very egotistical and incredibly arrogant. But, of course, it never landed on anybody and nobody really took him seriously. So he was pretty hard on his band members, Tomo and Brainer. And it was his tenacity, really, and his self-belief that he was going to be this huge rapper star, despite the fact that, you know, there wasn't a hope in hell. But he never felt sorry for himself. He was always driving himself onwards and, you know, tried numerous jobs. You just knew each one was going to fail miserably. But yeah, equally obnoxious. Mm. Yeah.
But there is also, I felt a great sadness. I watched a few episodes again today just to remind myself of the series. I felt a sadness for him. And that Deirdre, I felt a particular sadness for Jeremy, played by Brendan Coyle, and you as Helen, his wife. I mean, their marriage falls apart when he comes out. But also, he's mentally really, really unwell. Was that a difficult line to tread, you know, between sympathy for the character and also laughing at the character?
I don't remember it being a difficult line to thread. I think it would be much more difficult now. And I think we'd all be much more aware now because the conversation around mental health is very healthy now. And then I don't think we were talking about it very much and I don't think we were very informed. So I just sort of rolled with it. Do you know what I mean? But I was quite taken aback when I watched it again 20 years on. By how light and breezy we were about the fact that this man was having a complete psychotic episode, probably, you know. But I don't remember it being difficult at the time. I mean, I suppose you're always reminding yourself that it's comedy. You're making a comedy. Mm.
And what about looking back at yourself, yourself 20 years ago, your younger self? Is that a joy or a pain?
I think it was quite painful. The hair. With the hair. I mean, I looked a good 10 years older than I was, but then apparently I've always looked older than I was. But the hair was ridiculous.
But you've watched a few episodes then, have you? Or did you just watch one?
Well, this, because I was coming to talk to you, I watched all six again. And I have been, you know, saying that I would watch them, but I never did. So I really enjoyed looking at them again. I think mostly, though, more than anything, I was just wildly impressed with Michael's performance as Rats. I think it's an astonishing performance.
Nah.
I do, and I think that's probably what was at the core of this show. It was why it was made, and I think because it was so strong, it just sort of, you know, lifted everybody and gave the thing momentum.
Yeah, he did get a further outing after the series briefly, didn't he, Michael? Rats?
Yeah, we did about 3-4 years later. We did a film that was just the Rat storyline called Spin the Bottle. We did that. And who knows? Who knows? We never closed the door on Rats or Helen, so who knows?
Interesting to see what they'd be doing in lockdown.
It would be. I don't think Rats would really be paying much attention to social distancing whatsoever. No, I would think a couple of cans would make him immune in some way.
And what about yourself? First of all, Michael, how are you managing the whole lockdown procedure now? Not much work out there, is there?
No. All work has completely stopped and I think will be stopped for quite some time. So, yeah, trying to keep sane. And, you know, fortunately the weather's good. We're not heading into winter. It's the other way around. And trying to keep busy.
Michael, yes? Would you not write the Path to Freedom 20 Years On series?
We kind of did 10 years ago, Dee, as you know. We'll see. Nobody's got any money, though. Nobody's got any money, so.
Well, it was cheap to make.
It was very cheap to make and very fast to make. And I suppose that's the nature of mock documentary, is that it's only one camera. And who knows? Yeah. Who knows?
All right. Well, listen, good to speak with you both. And I'll keep my ears peeled to see if it is going to come back 20 years later. Okay. That's Michael McElhattan and Deirdre O'Kane there speaking to me about Paths to Freedom, six-part series, first broadcast 20 years ago on RTE television and now available in full on the RTE player. Now, if ever there was a title made for these times, it has to be the new non-fiction book from English author Olivia Lang. Funny Weather, Art in an Emergency is a collection of wide-ranging pieces about artists and writers, the art they make and the lives they lead. Lang's subjects range from Georgia O'Keeffe and Derek Jarman to Sally Rooney. Sinead Gleeson has been reading the essays and she joins us now. First of all, maybe give us some sort of context for Olivia Lang, Sinead. The Lonely City was really the book that made her name, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. This is her fourth book. She's mostly written nonfiction, and she's one of those nonfiction writers where she tends to pick a subject, pivot around it, and then draws in elements of her own life to it. So the first book was At the River, and it followed the route of the River Ouse, which some people will know is the river where Virginia Woolf took her own life. But it's bringing in elements of her own life and her interest in nature. There's a book that followed that called The Trip to Echo Spring, which I'm told is the euphemism used in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof for when you go to the drinks cabinet. And it's a book about writers and drinking. And then, as you say, The Lonely City, I think around the time of that book, she was awarded a very substantial Wyndham Campbell Prize, which is a lot of money. And it's a book, the subtitle is Adventures in the Art of Being Alone. And it starts with Olivia going to New York when her life has been upended and she doesn't have a lot of money, so she sublets small flats and spends a lot of her days walking the city and going into galleries. So she's somebody who sort of draws a lot of her interest is art, artists, ways of seeing, all of that kind of stuff, and that's in all of the books. And again, it features in this one. This book is slightly different to those ones, and then this is more of a miscellany. It's a collection of columns she wrote for Freeze, the art magazine, and various introductions to books about writers she likes, and her thoughts and essays on politics, writing, and on various subjects. So it's not as closely thematic maybe as the first three nonfiction books.
And have all of these essays, and there are some reviews in here as well, have they all been published before, or is there some new work in there too?
There's a couple of conversations she has, bigger pieces on sort of artistic movements. There's a piece at the end where she's talking to another artist. But most of the pieces, yeah. So the Freeze columns are on everything from she had a life. At one point, she was a sort of an environmental protester and lived in a camp. There's a very good piece called Feral. That's from one of the later essays. And there's two big pieces on kind of queer British art and British conceptual art, which appeared to me to be new. But I'd read a lot of these pieces before, and it's really interesting to see how they sit cheek by jowl together. And then obviously, of course, to have that prophetic title of Art in Emergency. I'm thinking how Sarah Baum's handiwork and Mark O'Connell's Notes from an Apocalypse are also, you know, didn't know what kind of world they'd be coming into, but all feel very timely reads at the moment.
She frames, Lang frames this collection in terms of what, it's a reference to another essay, in fact, I think, reparative reading and paranoid reading. What does she mean by that, and what's the difference between the two things?
Yeah, it's a great essay, an Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick essay, which is called Paranoid Reading and Reparative Reading, or You're So Paranoid You Probably Think This Essay Is About You, with a nod to Carly Simon. So reparative reading is basically our usual form of reading. We're looking for information, we're trying to find out things, we're being analytical, whereas reparative reading is basically trying to approach reading where you're more curious about it. You're seeking out hopeful things, and you're trying not to be negative in your approach to reading. So she sort of does that in this book. And there's a lot in this book. There's lots of sections. There is, as you would expect, a section on artists' lives, which are essays about artists from Basquiat and Hockney to Georgia O'Keeffe, and talking about what she likes about them. I think one of the best essays in the book is about Agnes Martin, a painter I didn't know, whose personal life was as interesting as her work, in terms of, at one point, which feels very relevant to now, she went off to live in New Mexico in the desert, surviving solely one winter on gelatine mixed with orange juice and bananas. But she, you know, she was a contemporary of Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. They all lived in a big lockup in New York before her mental health led her to sort of flee the city and went out. And that's, I think, a whole hallmark of Olivia's work, and particularly the work that harks back to the Lonely City. She's interested in outsiders, marginalised people, people on the periphery. And sometimes some of those people have been forgotten. Obviously, Georgia O'Keeffe and Hockney haven't. But some of the people who feature throughout this book will not be familiar to readers. And that's some of the most interesting kind of revelatory pieces.
Yeah, there's an essay within the book as well called The Fire This Time. And she brings together Dante's Inferno, the Great Fire of London, and in fact, the Grenfell Tower blaze. It's an extraordinary piece of work, how she brings history and contemporary stuff right together.
Yeah, she's very good at doing that in terms of her topical columns. And again, I think Frieze is most people will think of it as an art column, and we're surprised to find Olivia not writing an art column, but writing about topical issues. When she does write about things like that, she makes them very contemporary. So she's talking about refugees, she's talking about Trump, she's talking about Brexit. People will know probably that she wrote a small, very autobiographical novel called Crudo, which sort of had a similar sort of time frame. And then even when she writes about an essay about violence, she uses the artist Anna Mendieta, someone who I'm interested in and I've written about myself, as how violence is portrayed in art. So she's a very kind of mercurial kind of writer. The essays and pieces are never singular. They're often used to pull in loads of different topics and threads, and she does this, I think, particularly well. There's another section called Four Women, where she profiles four artists, and that's much more straightforward. They're profiles, they're quite meaty. There's a brilliant piece about Henri Mantel where they get to sit down and have a long conversation about Mantel's work, her life, the impact of her health on her writing. Overall, she's able to, I think, not draw lots of things out of dead people on the page, but also the people she physically meets in real life, like Mantel, like Ali Smith, painter Chantal Jaffe. She's very good at getting people to reveal things about themselves, while often not revealing too much about herself as the interviewer, which is a real skill, I think.
Absolutely. I wonder, did she know, art in a time in an emergency and funny weather, yes, it's very opposite. Did she know she was going to be part of the big debate happening in this country at the moment? Sex dominates the book, is how one of the paragraphs of her review of Sally Rooney's Normal People starts. But she goes on to talk about how Rooney is fluent at communicating this secret internal aspect of sex. Did you look back at that review in the light of the recent debate around the television series?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember that she was very positive about Normal People at the time, and talks about, I mean, I think what she's interested in, which is something Lang is interested in, is sexuality and bodies and I think intimacy, and all of those things are obviously very prevalent to Normal People. But she does say, and I think Olivia Lang doesn't give high praise very easily, but the last line of the essay is, Rooney is miraculously astute about human relations, the best young novelist, indeed one of the best novelists I've read in years. So you don't say things like that very lightly unless you really mean it. But she's very good at writing about other people's work while making a critical voice for herself and her own kind of essays, which is one of the things I like most about her. She talks also about Arthur Russell, a wonderful musician who she made a BBC documentary about, and she said that one of the magical things about Russell's music is the way it conveys feelings, especially feelings that are not easily translated into words. And I think that's something that Lang does herself when she's writing about other people's work and writing about art and visual art particularly.
Didn't you mentioned there that the section that is four women dealing with Hilary Mantel, Ali Smith, Sarah Lucas and Chantal Jaffe, a painter who did a portrait, I believe, of Olivia Lang. Didn't she land herself in some trouble with a publication that had predominantly featured male writers? Is there any balance redressed, or did she address that in any way in this collection?
Yeah, absolutely. The drinking book I mentioned at the beginning was all the kind of, the Berrymans and Hemingways, as you'd expect. And I think a lot of people wondered why there hadn't been any women in the book. But in a piece within this, where it's just simply called Drink, 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 she talks about, so she writes that balance. So, you'd expect Jean Rhys is here, Marguerite Duras, Patricia Highsmith, Elizabeth Bishop, Anne Sexton. So she does kind of talk about there's a different, and also there's the idea that women drinking is different to men. She said it's as if a child was drinking. There's a shaming of how women drink, and how where there's a kind of valorizing of the big male canonical writers who drink and often end up in a very bad way, but it's different for women who are in a very different way. There's a brilliant essay called Skin Bags, where she talks about her own body and it being a life model. So she puts herself in that framework in the line of art, and she lets Chantal Jaffe painter. And again, it's one of those things where we're not always happy what we see because other people have a different version of what we're seeing. And that's what the whole book is about. It's how you look at things. It's how you appraise things. And she obviously, there's an essay about John Berger, who, you know, famously wrote so much about the ways of seeing and how we look at art and photography and images. And I think that's what Lang is doing throughout the book, reminding us there's always, you know, look at something and look again.
I can hear that you're a fan of Olivia Lang's in general and that you have enjoyed reading this book. Have you any reservations about the collection, Funny Weather, Sinead?
Well, just that it's not a completely new book. I would have loved cover to cover all new work. And I think sometimes there is, and it happens when you're pulling pieces from different places, there's a little bit of repetition. Obviously, she's written a lot about Derek Jarman, about the queer artist David Wanorowicz. She wrote the introduction to Close to the Knives when his memoir was republished. So you'll know, if you're familiar with the work, you'll spot little repetitions, even across the book, not harking back to the other work. But that doesn't really matter because she's a very curious and I think empathetic sort of writer. She's very clear-eyed in her analysis. And her criticism is really rigorous, but it has a warmth, I think, that sometimes is often lacking in a lot of cultural criticism. It can be quite chilly, and I don't think that she has that. And I think it's just a very interesting cross section. You'll find something that Agnes Martin sent me down a YouTube internet rabbit hole for half a day looking up all her work and finding out more about her life. And I love when work does that, when I need to go off and find out more about someone. And I think a lot of people won't be familiar. I mean, there's an essay about Freddie Mercury, we all know him. There's Warhol, there's Bowie, but there'll be lots of people that you don't know, which I recommend the book for that reason.
All right, that's Sinead Gleeson speaking to us about Olivia Lang's latest publication, Funny Weather, Art in an Emergency, which is published by Picador. And bringing us to 23 minutes to 8 on Wednesday night's Arena. Can you write a play in 600 words? What can you even say in such a neat word count? Fishamble Theatre Company has issued a tiny play challenge. Anyone, anywhere in the world, can send in a very short script to them responding to the keyword change. The deadline is this Friday, the 8th of May. Can you get 600 words done that quickly? Jim Culleton, Fishamble Artistic Director, joins me now on the line. Jim, Fishamble's full name is, of course, Fishamble, the new play company. That's what you're looking for here, but it's a very specific type of play that you're looking for here.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's right, Sean. I think it's an initiative that's come about, I suppose the whole world with theatres shut down and with no live performances happening on stage. We've been thinking of ways to stay connected with people and to keep people creative and to generate work in different ways. So we've invited people to submit 600 word plays to us about the theme of change. It's kind of inspired by an initiative we had after the last recession, kind of around 2009, when we ran an initiative called Tiny Plays for Ireland, and we asked people to send us plays, and we staged 50 of those. This time around, we're asking people to send us plays, which we will select and then publish on our website. So over the past kind of 4 weeks, we've been doing a weekly one just for people living in Ireland, and we've had hundreds of entries for that, and those plays are up on the Fishamble website, on fishamble.com, and there's some fantastic plays. And now, as you say, we've extended this final call to be a global call, really, and we've already had the same number of submissions in as we got for the whole previous 4 weeks, and we're expecting a lot more over the next few days as people reach the deadline, because that's human nature to kind of to submit something when the deadline is approaching.
Absolutely. And the previous prompts in the previous 4 weeks, community, nature, trade, essential were the four words that you gave. Change was a very interesting word to choose. How do you even come up with those single words that are so open? Is it a long process to narrow it down?
Yeah, it's kind of, I think it's, you know, it's like if you say to somebody you can write about anything at all in the whole wide world, you know, it could be very hard to begin. And yet we didn't want to curtail people or restrain people in any way. But we thought one word as a prompt would be a good starting point and hopefully a good balance between something to hang on to and yet enough to let your imagination go wild. So the words were come up with by Gavin Costick, our literary manager. And so we thought change for the final one would be a really good one because I suppose we're all living in a very changed world. We kind of felt it's an opportunity for people all over the world to talk to each other. There's a real sense of us being a small village in a way, you know, with everyone in the world dealing with the current pandemic. So it's a chance to think about change and what change means. And the previous prompts have similarly, I suppose, prompted people to write about what they're feeling at the moment and the way we're living through the changed world at the moment. But there's been, very funny plays and plays of great hope as well as kind of as well as more gloomy ones. You know, there was one of the plays we had already that was published from the last 4 weeks is set in 2050, with the action looking back 30 years. And there's a play about a man doing the shopping for his mother who's cocooning, but he disagrees with how much alcohol she wants him to buy her, and he's kind of concerned about him kind of facilitating kind of her drinking habit. And there's one about two people wearing hula hoops, kind of, you know, keeping them 2 meters apart, so that, you know, and working it out mathematically. So there's lots of interesting kind of takes on it, and we're looking forward to seeing what people come up with that, the word change as the prompt this time around.
Yeah, I looked through the website and just dipped into a few of the plays. And the whole COVID-19, this current crisis, it's not every play deals with it, but it's fairly prevalent. Are the majority of plays touching on it in some way?
Yes, indeed. I think they are. You know, we didn't say that people had to write about that. We kind of said, look, this is one of the ways in which Fish Amble is connecting with people and creating work and generating work and engaging with our audiences as well as artists. And we gave words that suggested sort of themes that people could link to current times, but we kind of found that everyone really, what people wanted to write about and wanted to get off their chest was their observations about what's going on at the moment and the altered world we're living in. So certainly all the plays kind of are very current and very topical, even though some are set in the past and some are set in the future. They're all really about now, and people kind of grappling with what we're living through and trying to make sense of it. And I suppose that's one of the great things theatre can do, and that the arts do in general, I suppose, that they kind of allow us to grapple with issues and help make sense of things, and that's what people certainly have done with their submissions to the initiative so far.
Yeah, and certainly if people go and read some of the plays, they'll get a sense of what makes a good 600 word play. And Gavin Kostick also, as you mentioned, your literary editor, if I'm giving them the right title, he also gives some hints as to how I go about writing the play. What would you say makes a good tiny play, Jim?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of, sometimes people say to us, you know, oh gosh, do 600 words, does that have to include the stage directions and does it have to include the characters' names? And we kind of say to people, look, you know, you might find that the idea you have doesn't really suit a 600 word play if you're struggling with the length. Whereas I suppose the best plays are the ones where people go, oh yeah, I have something to say and I can say it really briefly. In the same way that, you know, you might decide to write a short story rather than a novella or a novel, or something might suit a haiku or a sonnet rather than an epic ballad poem or whatever. So it's kind of, it's sort of similar, I think, for a tiny play, that if you have one idea, you know, probably there isn't really time for a subplot. There isn't time for lots of secondary characters. So one idea with a small number of characters that encapsulates something kind of, you know, in a pithy kind of way, really, you know, is what we're looking for, you know. So something that comes from the heart, but something that can be, that just is a small little glimpse at one aspect of a relationship or one aspect of life, you know, and can be done in that short time frame.
All right, so change is the word that you have to think about if you want to submit a tiny play to Fish Amble before this Friday, the 8th of May. And you submit your scripts to gavin@fishamble.com, and you find out full details on the website, tinyplaychallenge@fishamble.com. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. A Hero's Death, that's the new single from Fontaines DC, just out today, in fact, and you can check out YouTube, the great video up there featuring Aidan Gillen playing the part of a talk show host. This year, 2020, marks 50 years since the death of the writer Martin O'Kane. Born and reared in Spittle, County na Gaillimhe, O'Kane had a rich literary style in his native language, publishing many works in his lifetime, including, of course, Craoine na Cille. The novelist and playwright and scholar, Alan Titley, translated Craoine na Cille for Yale University Press in 2015 as The Dirty Dust, the first time the novel was translated into English, in fact, and Titley has just published a translation of O'Kane's novella, Fuil Fuinne, or The Dregs of the Day. And Alan Titley joins me now on the line. Let's just start with Martin O'Kane himself, Alan. How important a figure is he in Irish culture?
Well, he's very important insofar as he would be seen to be the most important prose writer of the second half of the, well, in the 20th century, I suppose, entirely. Because of basically the classic that he wrote, Train to Killer, but also because he's a huge collection of short stories, starting with what might appear to be very traditional stories, given a modern twist, and later on writing very modernist stuff as well in the 50s and late 50s and the early 60s, and also simply because of the sheer amount of stuff that he wrote. In other words, he believed that a writer should write and should be producing work all the time. And in that sense, he was amazingly important. If you were to take Máirtín Ó Cadhain out of the canon of modern literature in Irish in the 20th century, there would be a huge hole.
You have said that Ó Cadhain, I think this is in your introduction, in fact, to your translation of Caoimhín Ó Cadhain, that he was a traditionalist and a modernist. Is he the kind of the James Joyce of the Irish language?
Well, he was certainly very much influenced by James Joyce. In fact, one of his later books, which wasn't published until after his death, a novel, it's not really a novel, it's just a piece of prose called Barbed Wire, which was a bit like Finnegan's Wake, and it's got a totally mad piece of work. And he also had several short stories in a Joycean style as well. And we know that he was actually said, he tells a story of himself in Croke Park in one of those few times when Galway were in an All-Ireland final. And he was walking down, he heard somebody saying, "There goes a Joycean galoot," because somebody has said that about him as well. So yeah, he was, but in the sense that if Joyce is seen to be the most important and experimental writer in English in Ireland in the 20th century, then yes, Ó Cadhain is a Joyce of the Irish language as well.
Let's listen to a clip featuring Ó Cadhain himself. In 1970, he took part in an RTÉ radio programme called Speak Your Mind, one of the only broadcast interviews, in fact, that he did in English. He was asked if he ever made concessions to his readers in terms of the difficulty of the language he uses.
No, I don't think one can. They're written in a Western dialect, of course. This is my native dialect. But it's one of the big dialects of Irish, if not the biggest. And one must write and to describe the kinds of things which any person living at the present day wants to describe, in the nature of emotions and the nature of all the things that surround him, the culture that is around him. I think his language must be somewhat difficult, and in this way, it's my Irish is not a learner's language. It's the kind of language which I struggle with to describe what I think and what I see, whether my thoughts or the things I see are important or not. I don't know.
Máirtín Ó Cadhain there speaking in the programme Speak Your Mind on RTÉ Radio back in the 1970s. And Alan Titley is with me this evening because he's just translated a new Máirtín Ó Cadhain book, Fuil Fuinne, The Dregs of the Day. The sort of things that he's talking about in that clip, did he make concessions, and should he have even thought about making concessions, Alan?
Yeah, he didn't make any concessions, and he shouldn't have thought about making concessions. It was, I think, Liam O'Flaherty who once advised him that he should take his scissors to his language, and I think if he had done so, he wouldn't have been Máirtín Ó Cadhain. There are writers who love words for their own sake, and because they feel that it's only by using those words to their fullest extent that they can say what they want to say, and there are others who cut them back down. And he was one of the, it was Sean O'Riordan who called him a Rabelaisian writer, and he did mean Rabelais in the sort of stupid sense that we use as kind of a bawdy writer, because that wasn't the case, although he could be bawdy as well, but in the sense that he loved words and expressions and experimentation and going over the top. That was the way he was right from the beginning, because when he translated a book, Sally Kavanagh, a really bad novel by Charles Kickham, back in 1928 for Ngoom's Scheme, the work from which he translated was about 56,000 words, and he sent in the translation which came to over 90,000 words. So he couldn't help himself. This was the way he was, and the only thing any writer can do is to be true to himself, which he was.
And if he made no concessions in terms of the Irish that he used, that much must have made your job, both in terms of Caoimhín Ó Cadhain and the current work, The Dregs of the Day, or Fuil Fuinne, that must have made it particularly difficult. How do you approach O'Kane's work in that respect as a translator?
Well, I, in one sense, I don't see myself as a translator. I mean, I have translated a lot of stuff along the way. I remember being at a conference in Scotland some years ago about translation, literary translation, and there was a famous translator there from Scotland, and he went through a whole list of the series of translation, whether it should be literal, whether it should be metaphorical, whether you should go back to the original, how much should you kind of make an original work, and so on. And when it was over, I asked him, I said, listen, when you translate a work, which of these series do you follow? Do you pick out a series? He said, no, I just sit down and I do it. And that's kind of what I did as well. In other words, and the writing of the translating of Cré na Chéile was very different from the translating of Fuil Fuinne, because Cré na Chéile is a really big word store, where Cré na Chéile, The Dregs of the Day, is a much simpler novel. After all, as he said himself, he lived in Dublin longer than he lived in Connemara, and he lived in Dublin most of life, and this is a novel set in Dublin. I think you presume it's Dublin. It sounds like Dublin. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say it's Dublin, but it is city language, and he's using the idiom and he's using Irish in a much more modern way, and he uses strange phrases his own. In one way, it is much more simple than Cré na Chéile. On the other hand, it is still Máirtín Ócáin. So when you say, how do I approach it? I start on a page and I fiddle around with it, and when it comes out and it feels right, then I keep on going.
Yeah, Cré na Chéile is set in the graveyard, and the dead are all speaking to each other, and lots of gossip and lots of rows going on, if we're to believe what it tells us. It's The Dregs of the Day sounds like a very different proposition altogether. Is it just a single voice, or it sounds like a very concentrated story? Who's speaking to us?
Well, it is a very simple, a very much more direct story. And remember, this was the very last story in the last book that was published in his lifetime. It only came out a very short while before he died. And it is, as I said, it's a novella. It was with a collection of short stories. It's a man, and he's not the one who's doing the talking. It is about him, even though we suspect that his is the real voice in it. And it's a man whose wife has just died, which has come as a shock to him in a way, and he's totally lost, he's totally bereft, as the phrase has it, and he wanders around the city for a weekend not knowing what to do. He can't come to terms with it, he can't do anything practical. He meets a whole lot of strange characters. He meets prostitutes and priests and sailors and people who want to give him advice, and gamblers and so on, and he kind of gets a bit of advice and he loses it and he leaves it there, and he follows on, and he's looking for some kind of salvation, some kind of thing that will help make a decision, and he can't simply do so. It's a kind of an odyssey over the weekend of a man who's totally lost and totally wandering and just not knowing what to do. So in that sense, it is entirely different. There is conversation in it, but most of it is not. Most of it is reflection, whereas Cré na Chéile, the dirty dust, if you like, is actually mainly conversation, nearly all conversation, apart from little bits in between.
And so does The Dregs of the Day, does it have the wildness and humour of Cré na Chéile? Are we in a different tonal world?
You're in a very different tonal world. It does have it doesn't have the wildness of it, but it does have some of the wit. There's a kind of a black humour running through it. Ócáin couldn't write, well, that's not true. A lot of things he wrote, especially his latter works, had a kind of a dry humour running through them all, and this is the same thing. So Ócáin, as any great writer does, has many different voices. Cré na Chéile was one of those voices. Anuachan, another one of his novels, which was published after death, is a different one. His early stories was a different one, and his later stories are different voice as well. So he could take on, he was kind of a ventriloquist, if you like. He could take on whatever voice he needed to give you in order to write a story, if you like.
How was he thought of in his home place in Spittal, finally, Alan?
Well, he was hugely respected because he obviously was a man of the people. He only had a normal education, went to the primary school, and never had any third level education apart from 2 years in St. Patrick's College to become a primary school teacher. It was a 2-year diploma course, and then he ends up as professor of Irish in Trinity. So he was well known for many reasons. One was, of course, that he was involved in Gaeltacht activities from the 1930s, trying to get rights for Gaeltacht people, and also because when Cré na Chéile was published in a serialised fashion in the Irish press, before it was published as a book, it was read out loud throughout the Gaeltacht where he was from, and people would be waiting for next installment of it. And then later on, of course, he was involved in Charta Sivilt in the Gaeltacht and the Gaeltacht Civil Rights Movement, from which Red in the Gaeltacht came, and many other things as well. So when he went home, he was hugely respected. And of course, even though, as I was saying, he lived most of the latter part of his life in Dublin, he was over and back to Connemara all the time. So he was highly respected there because he was one of their own without any kind of snobbery or any kind of uppityness. Right. And he had made it and they knew it. And of course, they also knew he was a great writer.
All right. Well, Gurumila Mahagatha Svehaging Anok. That's Alan Titley there talking to us about his translation of On Fuil Fuinne, The Dregs of the Day, which is available through Yale University Press. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Pather Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.